Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, hear from writer, entertainer, drag queen, and LGBTQ plus rights activist Rory O'Neill. This program was hosted in partnership with the Consulate General of Ireland, Chicago, as part of their Bloomsday festivities, the annual global celebration of Irish writer James Joyce that commemorates the events of his 1922 masterpiece, Ulysses. O'Neill is interviewed by AWM President Kerry Cranston. This conversation originally took place June 16, 2026, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer. Content alert. This conversation includes adult themes, topics, and language. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Happy Bloomsday. Thank you for being here. My name is Kerry Cranston. I'm the president of the American Writers Museum. We are thrilled to be in partnership with the Irish Consulate today for this special Bloomsday program. We have a special connection to the Irish community. We've done a number of programs with the Irish Consulate over the years. For anyone who don't know this story, our museum is founded by an Irishman from Ireland who came to the U.S. To have his career. He was an engineer with no museum background, no formal literary background, but like all Irish people, he was deeply steeped in love of literature and reading, and in his retirement, he became a docent at the Library of Congress. He was giving tours. He went home to Ireland. He was at the Dublin Writers Museum. He came back to the United States, and he said, "Where is the American Writers Museum?" And people told him there wasn't one, and he fixed it. So welcome to the work of a stubborn Irishman who said, "Of course there should be one, and I will make it happen." I'm going to give a shout-out because there's someone in the crowd who's one of our trustees, Marion Cameron, who's also been involved from the beginning and also of Ireland. And so we are a museum that has a deep connection to Irish literature, just as American culture is a deep connection to Irish literature. And so we're thrilled to have this event. And I'm going to let Padraig talk for a couple minutes.
Thanks very much, Kerry, and good afternoon, everyone, and happy Bloomsday. As Kerry said, I'm Padraig Manning. I'm the Vice Consul and the Deputy Head of Mission at Ireland's Consulate here in Chicago, working around the Midwest. I'm also joined by my colleagues from the Consulate, and in particular, I'd just like to acknowledge Sandra Hamilton, our Public Diplomacy Officer, who did so much to put this event together. Firstly, I'd like to extend a big thanks to Kerry and his team for opening the doors of the American Writers Museum for us today. The American Writers Museum, it's a wonderful space, but as Kerry said, it's also a museum with strong Irish links, and those connections are something that we're particularly proud of, and they're something that it really stands to the global reach of Irish literature, so it makes it the perfect place for us to celebrate Bloomsday here in Chicago today. So Bloomsday, as many of you will be aware, is a one-of-a-kind literary celebration. And over the past 100 years or so, it has become one of the largest literary celebrations in the world. It commemorates James Joyce and his groundbreaking 1922 novel Ulysses. But in more recent years, it's really provided us with an opportunity to celebrate the written word more generally, and the contributions of Irish writers over many generations. So today we're absolutely thrilled to be partnering with the American Writers Museum. The contributions of Irish writers over many generations have made Ireland a literary force well beyond our size. And among those voices are voices from the LGBT community. So we're really delighted that today's program will focus on some of those contributions with a very, very special guest in Rory O'Neill. So Rory O'Neill is someone who will be known to many of you. He is also known by the stage name Panty Bliss and has been a leader in the LGBT community in Ireland for decades, and in particular played...
What a bitch.
I should probably have
for
run
some
this,
years.
For some years. And Rory, he has been a leader for some years. I stand corrected. And played a particularly important role in the successful campaign for marriage equality in Ireland in 2015. So. We're honored that Rory has chosen to join us for Bloomsday this year. He joins us as part of a tour of the Americas, having spent time in Sao Paulo and Miami, and now in Chicago with us. And we're really looking forward to the conversation with Kerry to explore elements of Irish literature that have at times been under-acknowledged in global celebrations of Irish literature. So Rory, thanks very much for joining us. Kerry, thanks for hosting us. And happy Bloomsday, everyone. I hope you enjoy the event. Thank you.
Thank you.
And can I just say, before we let Kerry start, I am not a Joycean scholar. This is going to be Kerry's role here this evening. But like many of the characters in Ulysses, I am a queer fabulist and have always been. And like Joyce himself, I have not always been super popular with the Irish state. But eventually, they realize their terrible mistake and now they fucking love me.
Well, with that, I'm going to have trouble following up on everything Rory has to say today. So I'm going to just kind of kick us off talking about the fact that, you know, it is Pride Month. It's Pride Month here, it's Pride Month in Ireland, it's Pride Month around the world. And the fact that Bloomsday falls within Pride Month, I think, is both ironic and amazing, because this is a book that has had a gigantic impact on literature around the world, on literature in Ireland, on literature in America, on writers everywhere. And it was a book that at its time was something that came up against Victorian morality and repression and really pushed boundaries, which led to it being censured and out of print and unavailable, and people fighting for the chance to actually read the book and get it published. And that type of pushback on who you are and your art and what you're doing is the same thing that the LGBT community was fighting for so very long. Doesn't mean that Joyce was an LGBTQ ally. In certain instances, his portrayals are not necessarily positive, but they are also very grounded in certain elements and are looking at both the past and the present. And he isn't shy away from having them as part of the storyline, from homosexual desire between characters and gender identity. There's a lot going on in this text. And I thought we could start by doing a couple of readings, because that's what you're supposed to do on Bloomsday. I'm going to do one, and Rory's going to do one, and then we can talk a little bit about the relationship between them. And there's my little turn-down page. I'm going to read a short passage. So there's a chapter in which Stephen Dedalus and Buck Mulligan and some others are in the library. If you know the book, if you don't worry about it. It's a really easy read. And they're having a discussion about Shakespeare and other things, and it's meant to be an academic discussion that Stephen was supposed to give. At the end of it, Buck is a figure who obviously represents the ideas of Oscar Wilde. So we're dealing with that notion of Wilde after his death, after the imprisonment and everything that happened to Oscar Wilde, for being a queer person, for having this livelihood this way of life. And so Buck Mulligan really represents that in his flamboyance and who he is and how he acts. And Joyce wasn't always a fan of how he acted, because he was someone who almost asked for the acceptance of the aristocracy and the system, and Joyce fought back against that because he didn't want that acceptance of the aristocracy and the system. He wanted them to change. And so in this bit, Buck is now going to talk about his great idea about Shakespeare in a new play that he wants to write. And he says, in a sweetly varying voice, as Buck Mulligan read his tablet, and he's describing a scene from a play that he's putting together, and it's called Every Man His Own Wife, or The Honeymoon in the Hand, A National Immorality in Three Orgasms by Bullocky Mulligan. He turned a happy patch's smirk to Stephen, saying, "The disguise, I fear, is thin, but listen," he read, "the characters. Toby Tostoff, a ruined Pole. Crab, a bushranger. Medical Dick and Medical Davy, two birds in one stone. Mother Grogan, a water carrier. Fresh Nelly and Rosalie, the Qualique whore. He laughed, lolling to and fro, head walking on, followed by Stephen, and mirthfully he told the shadows, souls of men, O night in the Camden Hall, when the daughters of Aaron had to lift their skirts to step over you as you lay in your mulberry-colored, multicolored, multitudinous vomit. The most innocent son of Aaron, Stephen said, for whom they ever lifted them. About to pass through the doorway, feeling one behind, he stood aside. Part, the moment is now. Where then? If Socrates leave his house today, if Judas go forth tonight, why? That lies in the space which I in time must come to ineluctably. My will, his will, that fronts me, sees between. A man passed out between them, bowing and greeting. Good day, Buck Mulligan said. The portico. Here I watched the birds for augury, Angus of the birds. They go, they come. Last night I flew, easily flew. Men wondered. Street of harlots after. A cream fruit melon he held to me. In, you will see. The wandering Jew, Buck Mulligan whispered with clown's awe. Did you see his eye? He looked upon you to lust after you. I fear thee, ancient mariner, O Kinch. Thou art in peril. Get thee a breech pad. Manor of Oxenford, day wheelbarrow, sun over arch bridge. A dark went before them, step of a par down, out by the gateway, under portico as barbs, they followed. Offend me still, speak on. So I'm going to stop there. And in this just little bit of time, we've seen Buck Mulligan and Stephen interrupted by Bloom, so the person passing through. And we heard what Buck Mulligan had to say about him and how he assumed that he was gay, and in a very negative light. And we've lost your page.
No, I was further back.
Oh, you are further back. There it is.
Yeah. And I'm going to read a part. In this chapter, it's written like a play, so all the characters, it's written like a play, so these are, you know, each character speaks, and poor old Bloom's gender has been called into question. I don't know why you asked me to read this part. So Dr. Mulligan speaks first. Dr. Bloom is bisexually abnormal. He has recently escaped from Dr. Eustace's private asylum for demented gentlemen. Born out of bedlock, hereditary epilepsy is present, the consequence of unbridled lust. Traces of elephantiasis have been discovered among his ascendants. There are marked symptoms of chronic exhibitionism. Ambidexterity is also latent. He is prematurely bald from self-abuse, perversely idealistic in consequence, a reformed rake, and has metal teeth. In consequence of a family complex, he has temporarily lost his memory, and I believe him to be more sinned against than sinning. I have made a pervaginal examination, and after application of the acid test to anal, auxiliary, pectoral, and pubic hairs, I declare him to be Virgo intacta. Bloom holds his high-grade hat over his genital organs. Dr. Madden. Hypsospadia is also marked. In the interest of coming generations, I suggest that the parts affected should be preserved in spirits of wine in the National Teratological Museum. Dr. Carruthers. I have examined the patient's urine. It is albuminoid. Salivation is insufficient. The patellar reflex intermittent. Dr. Punch Costello. The fetor judaeus is most perceptible. Dr. Dixon reads from a bill of health. Professor Bloom is a finished example of the new womanly man. His moral nature is simple and lovable. Many have found him a dear man, a dear person. He is a rather quaint fellow on the whole, coy, though not feeble-minded in the medical sense. He has written a really beautiful letter, a poem in itself, to the court missionary of the Reformed Priests Protection Society, which clears up everything. He is practically a total abstainer, and I can affirm that he sleeps on a straw litter and eats the most Spartan food, cold, dried grocer's peas. He wears a hair shirt of pure Irish manufacture, winter and summer, and scourges himself every Saturday. He was, I understand, at one time a first-class misdemeanant in Glen Cree Reformatory. Another report states that he was a very posthumous child. I appeal for clemency in the name of the most sacred word our vocal organs have ever been called upon to speak. He is about to have a baby. General commotion and compassion. Women faint. A wealthy American makes a street collection for Bloom. Gold and silver coins, blank checks, banknotes, jewels, treasury bonds, maturing bills of exchange, IOUs, wedding rings, watch chains, lockets, necklaces, and bracelets are rapidly collected. Bloom. Oh, I so want to be a mother.
So, I asked Rory to read that because the passage that I read from, and again in both of these, Buck Mulligan has an important part, and I think that, you know, what I wanted to ask you about in your book, you use a term in a famous speech that you give of gender discombobulation, and there seems to be a mixture here of the idea of, you know, the issue with sex and homosexuality, mm-hmm. and then the issue with gender and gender identity. Can you talk about in what you talk about in your book, which is this notion of the empowerment and disempowerment based on gender?
Well, you know, when I was about 19 years old, I started doing drag. And I did drag because it was stupid and fun and ridiculous and entertaining. And, you know, at that age, a drag queen's job is, you know, quite literally to get drunk for free, you know, to run around making a show of yourself. And, I mean, what 21-year-old doesn't want that job? Like, it's the perfect job. And in a way, I'd never had a political thought in my life at that stage. But despite that, or it doesn't actually matter whether a drag queen has had a political thought, you know, overtly about it, because what they're doing is still a political act, you know, whether they even recognize that or not. The very first time that I saw an actual live drag queen was in a summer that I went and I spent working in London and staying with my brother. And I went to this like crappy gay bar in some basement somewhere. And there was this drag queen at the back of the room, like a bad one. And, you know, she was lip syncing to something. And it was very that sort of traditional English drag style where they rip off the wig at the end as if we didn't know it was a man, you know. And, you know, she was wearing like a cheap dress and the makeup was terrible and the bar was terrible. Everything was bad. But it was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen in my fucking life. Because I had grown up in a culture and a society where, you know, where they had tried to sneer certain things out of me. You know, playground bullies had tried to sneer things out of me. And those things were all, you know, marked as feminine. There was feminine qualities about me that I was told constantly over and over again that marked me out as weak or pathetic or weird. And they wanted me to be ashamed of them. And in a way I was, as a teenager, I kind of was ashamed of them. Although I did learn very early that you could turn them to your advantage to be entertaining, and that could sometimes get you out of trouble. But I looked at this crappy drag queen in this crappy venue, and she was absolutely not ashamed of the very things that they had tried to sneer out of me. She wasn't afraid, you know, that her wrist would betray her. She wasn't trying to blend into the background. I mean, she was covered in fucking sequins. You know, she had a bloody spotlight. I mean, she was not trying to blend in the back. She was trying to stand out. She was trying to grab your attention. She was forcing you to look at her. And then she was, you know, reflecting back at you all of these things that they had tried to bully out of you. And she's throwing them back at you as strength, as power, as fun, as a sort of transgressive underground version of being. Something that to me seemed so liberating and brave and powerful, because, you know, I had already finally, you know, after some effort, discovered other queer people in Dublin, you know, just not long before that, and they were all hiding in hidden basements down side streets and, you know, behind blackout curtains, and I had a lot of fun in those places, you know, under glitter balls, you know, with bottles of poppers and the Pointer Sisters, but it was still very hidden, and there was still a shame attached to it. And this drag queen had none of that. And in fact, she was celebrating all the things that they had tried to sneer out of me. And that was incredibly powerful to me. And in a way, you know, I wish I remembered her name or anything, because in a way she changed my life. And you know, some people might argue, you know, I shouldn't thank her for it. But I, you know, she changed my life in the brilliant best way. She made me understand that I am who I am, and stepping into who you are is actually very powerful. And also, I've learned that, you know, drag too, and expressing gender in ways that you think is fun and exciting is liberating, not just for you, but also for the people around you. And it's also a great litmus test for who you want to be friends with, because the people who are pissed off by that, I don't want to be friends with them anyway. You know, they're dray, grab, dreary, afraid people. So I found that for me, getting over all of the rules and strictures around gender and how you express your gender or perform your gender, as Judith Butler might want to say, that's an incredibly liberating experience. But it has so many layers to it too, because, you know, the reaction to a man dressed as a woman is very different to the reaction to a woman dressed as a man. And of course, you know, you might have your own theories about that. Mine is that it's the same reason why, if you talk to any drag queen, she'll tell you that as soon as people have a few drinks on them, they will tell drag queens the most, you know, shocking, intimate details of their lives. Things that they have never told another soul before, but somehow, two drinks in and a drag queen, they are blabbing. And what is it about the drag queen that makes them want to do that? And I think it is that, first of all, they look at you and they see a man dressed as a woman and they think, well, she can't judge me, you know? Mm-hmm. Because we are in a culture that sees a man dressing as a woman to be demeaning. You know, that man has demeaned himself or weakened himself. And so a drag queen feels like a safe space to dump your trauma because she can't judge me. You know, this is a sweaty bloke with wax on his eyebrows and a nylon hat glued to his head in public. And so I'm going to tell him that thing that's been burning a hole in me, you know, because I've never told anybody else about the time that my cousin fingered me. Do you know? Like, you know, really intimate stuff. And I'm like, wow, Mary, I literally just met you. You know, that's a lot. But people feel safe to do that. And I think that's interesting because the converse also applies. I think when we see women kind of wearing masculine clothes or taking on masculine traits, we think, oh, she has empowered herself. Because the culture still sees women as a weaker sex and men as more powerful sex. And so somehow it's more acceptable for a woman to take on elements of butchness, you know, as we would say in the queer community. And it's much less acceptable for men because they're going the opposite direction. And so that is just my theory, that some part of them realizes, you know, well, this person has put themselves on a really low rung on the ladder. And so they can't judge me for this, you know, thing that's been burning a hole in my soul for, you know, the last 30 years. This is the person I'm going to tell it to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think all of those things are really interesting. I think how we view gender and think about gender is really interesting. Even those of us who feel we've liberated ourselves and that we still do it, it's a lifelong process of trying to unlearn all those things. And I do think it's fun that James Joyce was playing with all those same ideas, you know, all those years ago. And he would definitely not have considered himself an ally. I mean, he hated the Irish state and he did in the Catholic Church and all the things that I railed against, the very same things that I railed against. But he was absolutely molded by those things too. And some of those things, you know, those institutions that he absolutely would have hated to hear me saying that I think, you know, they were a big part of who he was. They absolutely were.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, and it's very clear in the book when these pieces come up, he is very much looking at the weakening of the human by making them female. Mm. You know, the at the same point, just past that in that chapter, the madam of the house then becomes male and then dominates over him. And so the entire scene is one in which there's entire gender reversal, and in that gender reversal, the power dynamic changes entirely. So it is, I think, very much to say that this is one of those situations. Then where gender is an empowerment, and where people live within that space is played with Ulysses. His own point of view, like you're saying, is being molded by the state and the society he lived in, and who he was. He still was a straight male, very much, and in that culture. I think, you know, we wanted to talk about some other people, and another interesting writer is Kate O'Brien, who comes shortly after Joyce, in the sense that her first novel is published, I think, in like 1936 or 37, and then is quickly banned in Ireland because there is some level of just gayness in it, you know, just a little bit, and so the characters. And how they're represented. The interesting thing about her is that they're represented in a positive light.
Yeah.
And that is inevitably what is seen. It's not said that this action is perverse or this action is wrong. And so these books get banned. And you've heard of Kate O'Brien and know people who've read her. And then eventually Land of Spices in 1941 is another book that's banned of hers. But it actually forces Ireland to change their laws and their censorship laws, because people fight so hard because the book is so well written and so good that it winds up that the censorship laws are changed in 46, and she's able to fight and get her book re-reviewed, and it is actually then put in print in 49. But it takes, you know, all of 8 years. But I think you brought up there's an interesting connection between you and her and Joyce, which is what happens to people living in that repression.
Well, I sort of kind of joke about it, but both, well, all Kate O'Brien, Joyce, and myself all ran out of Ireland in order to, in a sense, to be who we wanted to be, or to feel freer to explore who we were or whatever. Now, I would say the difference is that Joyce, of course, he was perfectly fine, sort of in his gender and sexuality in Ireland, which it probably reinforced everything for him. And I think there's probably a latent bit of bisexuality going on in Joyce anyway, which he was trying to cram down. So he was probably glad of the Catholic Church's repression in that one tiny aspect. But of course, as a writer and a thinker and all, he felt that, you know, he had to get out of the country. Kate O'Brien, I'm sure for very similar reasons, but also she was a lesbian. And she went abroad in order to be herself, and as you know, she died in England, didn't she? And she was in Spain for a long time before that, and everything. And I feel a super kinship to that, because that is exactly why I ran out of Ireland at the time that I did, when they didn't love me so much, and I didn't love Ireland then either, like very much like they. I wanted to love Ireland, but in the late 80s, I went to Japan. Another very traditional and restrictive society in many ways, but one way it doesn't give a shit is it doesn't give a shit about your sexuality, or certainly not if you're a foreigner. So I do feel that kinship with, certainly with Kate O'Brien and Joyce too, about that, that I too felt that the old Ireland, the Ireland that I think we've long passed, you know, since, wasn't a place that was warm or welcoming to people like me. And I felt actively rejected. And in fact, I would say that all three of us would agree with this. I didn't just leave Ireland because I wanted to be gay. It wasn't specifically that. But it is true that the Ireland that I fled in the 80s had this very rigid definition of Irishness. It was entirely rigid. And there was all of these neat boxes that you were meant to tick. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're meant to like you too. You were meant to play GAA and hurling. You were all of these things. And I did not tick most of those boxes at all. And so I actually felt a lot of kinship with Irish Protestants, because I felt that my Irishness was constantly being called into question because I was queer. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Protestants in Ireland used to feel the same way, that their Irishness was constantly being called into question because they were Protestant. And that used to just really piss me off. And it got to, certainly, you know, after I finished college, I thought, I am never going to be happy here, and I'm never going to be able to settle here, and I'm never going to be accepted here, because my literal Irishness is not accepted here. And so I left, like Kate O'Brien did, and Joyce did, and all that. Now, I hasten to add, because we're here in Bloomsday, that I feel very differently about Ireland now, and now I feel very lucky to be Irish, but not because I changed, I fucking didn't, but Ireland has changed dramatically since then, and I did go back to Ireland, but when I did go back, I was very determined to be part of this huge, diverse movement, and that wanted to change Ireland, and set out consciously to change Ireland, and my little personal project was to make Irishness, the concept of Irishness, more elastic, so that it could stretch around somebody like me. And, you know, and then there was many, many other people who were involved in a similar project, and many, many, many of those other people had, like me, left Ireland, because that's essentially what young Irish people do. It's like it's just a cultural aspect of being Irish. Young people go away, they see the world, and they see other viewpoints, and you know, they discover other ways of viewing the world, other ways of being in the world. Lots of them, of course, came to the US, and then we went back with these other perspectives, and you know, through a huge collective effort, we did change Ireland, and we did make Irishness more elastic, and we did make it into a concept that can stretch around many more other kinds of people. And now, you know, unlike when I left, now you can be queer and fully Irish, which is practically mandatory. Yeah. You can even be prime minister.
Yeah.
At least one. We'll talk quietly afterwards. So yeah, I mean, I do feel that kinship, and with a lot of other writers. I mean, there's a lot of other writers the same. But also, I think it's good for writers to get up and go and travel anyway. So yeah.
And I one other direct connection to Joyce that you may not even remember because you wrote the book a number of years ago.
Wrote my book, or you read his book?
No, you wrote your book a number of years ago. You make a reference to the letter your brother was supposed to write to your parents.
Oh yes, yeah.
And you compare it to Ulysses because he never finished it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. Did I say that in my book? Well,
you
I am
did.
Good. I'm good.
I have it marked down right
I'm
here.
I'm good. I'm better than I remember.
So you want to explain what that letter was about? You were back from Japan.
Yes. My older brother, he's 7 years older than me, is also gay. And, you know, having a gay brother is very common. You know, and my parents had 6 children, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. My mother thinks North Korean military parades are sloppy. But I came out first. My older brother is kind of a genius, and he left the country when he was 15 on a scholarship, you know, to this weird international school, and then he got a full scholarship to Harvard. So, you know, so after 15, you know, he never really lived at home. And we in the family had often quietly discussed over dinner that Lorcan might be a gay. But that took all the suspicion off me. So we had discussed openly that I think maybe Lorcan might be gay, but they never really had discussion about me. But then he was off, you know, in other parts of the world, so it was easy for him not to have to stir it all up. Whereas I then went back to Ireland and I said, well, I have to tell my parents because, you know, I'm hiding this huge thing from them. But it felt natural that my older brother should do it first. You know? Mm-hmm. So we discussed it, all the siblings, right. So then my brother spent years writing the perfect coming out letter. Because we did a lot of research, and my brother's a bit autistic, and he did a lot of research. He wants to do everything exactly perfectly right. And all the parents said, you should write a letter. This is before the internet and before WhatsApp and everything ruined everything. But and the reason you should write a letter is if you... A lot of gay people, they feel pressured to do it face-to-face because it seems like the brave or good thing. No, that's a terrible way to do it. Like, you as a gay person, you probably spent 10, 15 years coming to terms with your own sexuality, and you struggled, and you thought all the stupid things, and you tried all the wrong things, and whatever. And then you sit down at Christmas dinner, and over a mouthful of turkey breast, you announce to your dad that you're gay. And then he has to come up, he has to respond right there in that moment. And it took you 15 years to get your head around it, but you expect dad to be the perfect Hollywood dad that second right now over a mouthful of cranberry sauce. And of course he says slightly the wrong thing, and then you're all hype, you know, you're full of your, you know, energy, and you've been working 15 years to this point. So you get up on your high horse and tell him to go fuck himself, and the next thing, you know, Christmas has been ruined for the next 6 years, all because you didn't write a fucking letter. So write a letter, because then it allows them to take in the information, think about what they've just heard. It allows you to say it in the most beautifully elegant, poetic way if you want to. Then it gives them time to percolate it and then respond. So my brother started carrying around this old ancient laptop. All laptops were old and ancient then. And writing this, then he left it on an airplane, and so that set him back, you know, months. Anyway. He was constantly, and I'm like waiting, because I'm actually having to interact with my parents, because I'm back, you know, I'm living in Ireland. And then eventually my mother is driving the car, and I'm with her, thankfully on a very straight stretch of road. And she said something, I don't even remember now exactly what, but something that I misinterpreted. And I thought what she was saying to me was, we all know you're gay, just say it. So I said, yeah, well, yes, I am gay. And that is not what she had meant at all. So, yeah, so I ended up sort of outing my brother, because then it's just, well, I can't lie, and then, you know, so I said, and so is Lorcan, you know? So, yeah, so he never finished the fucking letter, and I ended up nearly killing my mother on a straight stretch of road on the way into Galway.
And in your book, you describe him as trying to write Ulysses in that letter.
Yeah. Well, and actually, now you remind me of another lovely story, because it's about letters and gays. I'm here, the real reason I'm here in Chicago is for the screening on Thursday. Not that you're not the real reason, you're a wonderful reason. But this was thrown in as an extra by the consul, because they realized I'd be here on today. But anyway, so the documentary screening, it's called The Queen of Ireland, and ostensibly it's about me. It's not actually, it's about Ireland and how Ireland has changed, but they're using me as a theatrical device to explain that. But and weird thing about making a movie is it takes up a lot of your time and your energy and all of that. And then it's a big part of your life. And then you finish making the movie, and then you go back to your ordinary, boring, regular life. You go back to washing wigs and watching Frozen Planet. And it goes off out into the world and has this life that's entirely separate from you, a life of its own. You know, and it goes off to film festivals and, you know, pops up in Air New Zealand's in-flight entertainment, whatever. And when that movie went into the world, this very unexpected thing happened, which is my mother, because if you watch the movie, the real stars of the movie are my parents. My dad has actually died since, but and my parents are a big part of the movie, and everybody falls in love with my parents. They're beautiful people, and you know, great people, and everyone always says, "Oh my God, your parents!" You know. And when that movie went into the world, my mother started getting letters, and they came from all around the world. They came from Chicago and Melbourne and Frankfurt and whatever. And there was even one that was just addressed to Panties Mammy, County Mayo.
But it got to her.
It did. Go on pushed. They're very good. But all of the letters were from older Irish men who had left Ireland in the 70s and 80s. Men who had, like, you know, run away. Yeah. Men who had escaped. And men who had decided that if Ireland didn't want, you know, their stories, they were going to go away and write those stories in Chicago and Frankfurt instead. And that was really Ireland's loss, too, because many of these men, they wrote brilliant, successful, interesting stories in these other places, you know, stories that Ireland could have benefited from but didn't bloody want to. And in all of the years since these men had left, they had never told their own mothers why they had left and why they'd never returned. And now it's too late, and they will never have another opportunity to tell their own mother. And so after seeing the movie, they sat down at kitchen tables in Chicago and San Francisco and London, and they told my mother, like as a kind of surrogate for their own, you know, they told my mother their stories, you know. Stories actually of a pointless cruelty that was inflicted by the old Ireland on its gay sons. And, you know, my mother is a real letter writer. She's the sender of birthday cards and best wishes, get well soon, all the town's gossip. And so she writes back to them. And I do not know what she writes to them. I've never asked, and she's never offered. But it really is. It's lovely. It is beautiful. But it's also desperately, pathetically sad. Like, it's shamefully sad. Mm-hmm. My mother and these pen pals, whose stories she knows, but she keeps to herself. So, you know, the fact that the Ireland as depicted by Joyce and people like Kate O'Ryan has changed so dramatically. And I would say, inarguably for the better.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody, given it any sort of serious thought, would want to go back to that other Ireland. And I love seeing young people in Ireland now who literally have no concept of that Ireland. Like, they don't even know it ever existed. And I think that's really beautiful and gorgeous. Yeah. And it's instructive, you know, for us to read these things and be reminded that that Ireland did exist. It's not actually that long ago, because Ireland's story, recent one, I think it proves that deep and dramatic social change is possible, and it proves that it's possible in a relatively short period of time. But I think, you know, a lot of the things that we see happening around the world now also goes to show that just as things can go in one direction, they can quite easily go the other way if we're not careful. And so I think it's good to read these writers that wrote about those times and be reminded of where we've come from, and to strengthen our resolve to make sure that we don't end up sliding back there.
You know, there are so many Irish writers since that time that now, you know, are out and can so easily write about these stories. Emma Donoghue in 94 and 95 published two books right back to back with strong, powerful lesbian characters that were very well received. She went on to write movies that were, or books that were turned into movies and films. But all of her work started right after decriminalization.
Yeah.
And so even if the, you know, you've got somebody like Kate Bishop who, the, you know, the eventually the censorship laws are changed and things are starting to move forward, but it's still a very slow movement. Mm. And you are coming of age in that era before decriminalization.
Yeah, I was 25 years old before homosexual acts between men was decriminalized.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in art college, which I went to solely because I thought I'd meet another gay person there. And I met one other gay person there. Like, it just shows you how weird the old Ireland was. I went out every single weekend during college trying to break the law.
Yeah.
And like, and I considered it an excellent Saturday night if I did manage to break the law. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you were living through that, and then as you said, you had to flee it because it was so intensely repressive to you and your art and who you wanted to be. Yeah. And then when you come back, it's suddenly legal now.
Yeah.
And how did
it was decriminalized in the years that I was living in Tokyo.
Yeah.
So I went back to a country that was, all, you know, the change had already started. And it felt, I went back to a very exciting place where it felt like change was possible and change was happening and that Ireland was becoming much more open and outward looking. And Dublin, the city that the book is about, was visually changing all through the 90s. We were, you know, new buildings were going up, and the trams that are so much a part of Joyce's Dublin, which we, like idiots, fucking ripped out.
Which we did too.
Yeah. And now in the 90s, you started putting them all back in. The 90s felt like a very exciting time. And of course, we were having our big booming economy for the first time ever. And for the first time ever, young Irish people didn't have to leave if they didn't want to. Thankfully, I think it's sort of embedded itself culturally that young people leave, because I think it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But it's even better that they don't have to if they don't want to. And I think the 90s is really the first time ever that young Irish people didn't have to leave. You know, there was work and opportunities in Ireland if they wanted it. So, it was a super exciting time to go back to Ireland.
And but it's also the time, you know, your career starts to bloom and blossom and
bloom.
And you know, so you are and this is, you know, something that, you know, people don't think about. You're thinking about, you know, you're joking, you got paid to get drunk, but you know, as your career progresses, you are writing shows, plays,
yep,
speeches. You know, writing is a huge part of your life because, yep, you know, talk to us about, you know, in this new era that you can suddenly be yourself in Ireland, you know, how important was that to you?
Well, I wouldn't have gone back and I wouldn't have stayed if I had thought that I wasn't going to be able to be myself. I mean, that was the whole point of me going back. My thing about the writing is I'm lazy and writing is hard anyway, but I really need somebody to put a gun to my head and say, "Right, bitch." So I usually, you know, have somebody who's pressurizing me and giving me deadlines and that. And I'd love to say I really enjoy the writing process. And of course I do if you happen to get into flow and it's all just pouring out of you. But I am lazy and I do find it difficult. But I do also feel that I had so many things to write about because Ireland was an exciting, weird, changing place during those years. And I also felt that I had a lot of stuff to say. Mm-hmm. Or that I wanted to say, and stuff that I thought it was important for Irish people to hear, because too often we were only given a particular kind of perspective, and very few until then, that period, very few of them were queer perspectives. And I think also it's good to write from the outside looking in, and I had felt for so long that I was on the outside, and I tried to cling to that self-image, even though here I am with the fucking Department of Foreign Affairs. You know, I've become co-opted by the mainstream, and I pretend I haven't been, but I know deep in my soul I have been, and how boring is that of me? I did feel I had stuff to say, or I had a perspective that people didn't take seriously, and I thought they should have taken seriously.
Yeah.
But I do think it is quite a statement about Ireland, how much it's changed, that I am taken seriously. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally chose to run around dressed as a cartoon for a living. And people in Ireland, every 7 years, quite a lot of serious people try to get me to run for the presidency. Which is fucking ridiculous. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, the only thing I can say that's a positive about it is I've already put all my sins out into the world. So there are no skeletons in my closet. And those skeletons, they look great. But, you know, it's hilarious to me, mm-hmm. that people take... Like, I'm always getting phone calls from, you know, serious journalists, you know, who want my opinion on everything from fucking immigration to cycling lanes. You know, and I get calls from the Taoiseach's office or the Department of Foreign Affairs. The department will send me off to Thailand to speak to businessmen. You know, like, it's so weird. It's hilarious and stupid, but it's also brilliant that that's the Ireland now.
You know? I think it's wonderful. I mean, you and I were talking, you know, all of these great writers who've come along, and you included, in this change, Colm Tobin, we're going to argue over how to say it, an extremely famous gay writer.
And he's gay?
and extremely, you know, well-respected in a number of books, but... There's a passage that we were talking about that I think comes from a speech or from an article, and I'm just going to read this because I know that you have a different perspective.
Slightly. I love Colm, and so I'm not going to trash him or
anything. So he's talking about, we were pushing an open door. For me, the biggest change in being gay in my lifetime came with the referendum on same-sex marriage in Ireland in 2015. It was a watershed in several ways. One, the campaign was run on both sides with civility. Few on the no side felt free to insult gay people or imply we were not equal citizens in Ireland. Two, we took the words love and family back from the Catholic Church, and we asked, we let our fathers and mothers and siblings ask with us if our love was to be less valued in Ireland than other love. And if so, how come? Who says? And we made clear as homosexuals that we were born into families and we wished not to destroy the family but to enrich it. Three, we knew this was happening in a changing society, a place becoming more liberal. We were pushing an open door. We were almost fashionable. Four, I don't think this could have happened in Ireland without the women's movement, without women who had known oppression, wanting their gay and lesbian siblings and children to be not only protected in Ireland, but cherished and treated as equal citizens in a republic. Which I think is a beautiful statement, but...
It is, and I agree with large parts of it. And I agree with the sentiment, obviously. Yes. And I fully agree with the last half, where he says this couldn't have happened without the women's movement and all that. It's absolutely 100% true. I have quibbles with two parts of it. The first part, he says that it was that the referendum campaign and all that was handled with, you know, civility on both sides. And I think, well, that is bollocks. I think maybe Colin was living in L.A. then, and I wasn't quite so whatever. Because, yes, we were called all sorts of terrible things during the referendum campaign. There were posters up on every lamppost saying that we were a danger to children. I mean, I take huge offense at that. I will say one thing. I am sometimes given way too much credit for things that I didn't plan. I get it. I'm the pretty one. But I'm often given this real sort of credit that I'm this Machiavellian genius and that I did that speech in the Abbey that sort of became a whole big thing and that was part of this plan and it was all going to... And that is absolutely bollocks. That is not what happened at all. I was in a... and we won't get into the weeds about this, but I was in a difficult situation. I lived next door to the Abbey. I'd had me show there many times. The Abbey were asking lots and lots of people to do things on stage they asked 300 people to do something after 300 performances of this play about the oppression of Dublin workers. I just happened to be the last person they were asking to do it on the last night. I was in a lot of trouble with a lot of lawyers at the time. And I wasn't able to sort of argue or defend myself because producers of radio and TV and all of that were all frightened of lawyers. And the Abbey said, oh, well, it's live theater. You can say whatever you want, of course. So I just thought, oh, Okay, you know, I live next door. I know them all. They've been good to me. Right, I mean, this isn't annoying. I had a lot on, but okay, I will do this 10-minute speech. And I'll just say exactly what I would like to say in public, but haven't been allowed to yet. So I made this speech. I didn't think anyone would ever see it, apart from the people who were in the auditorium that night, who were mostly American tourists and rich ladies from richer parts of Dublin. And it's the Abbey Theatre, darling. And then I ran off to do my usual stupid Saturday night bar show. And obviously I knew in the auditorium it had gone well. That's the end. Then it turns out it was filmed. They did put it up on YouTube. It became this huge big thing. But accidentally, what that speech, and again, I'm not taking any credit for this. I was making a selfish speech for my own reasons. But that speech, then this is like 18 months before the referendum, and probably a year before the referendum was officially called. The idea that there might be a referendum was in the air, but nothing, whatever. But that speech accidentally, so I'm not taking credit, but it accidentally sparked a proper, for the first time ever, deep, you know, serious conversation in Ireland about how the Irish state had treated its gay citizens up to that point. And it went on for weeks. You couldn't avoid it. And it was a proper airing out of dirty laundry. And because it wasn't a referendum campaign, that, you know, discussion was pretty respectful and good. And it allowed people to step forward and say, yes, I'm gay and I've been treated horribly. And it's cleared out a lot of stuff. So 18 months later, when the referendum campaign kicked in, we had just been through this deep discussion. And so, yes, it allowed in some ways for the referendum campaign to focus mostly on the actual issues. Because Ireland has a lot of referendums, and we know how it goes. And how it goes usually is it gets really nasty. And we have this, part of the reason why it gets so nasty is that we have, you know, legislation around fairness. And so let's say, so for every referendum, national broadcasters and national newspapers and all that, they have to give equal weight to both sides of the argument in the run-up to the referendum. And that sounds reasonable, that sounds fair, right? But actually, it is a nuts idea, because let's say, as we have had, you were having a referendum on children's rights. Well, everyone's going to be for that. Like, we all want kids, you know, to have a decent time, right? Well, now it means, because of the legislation, the national broadcaster and whoever else has to go out and find that one absolute weirdo who thinks that we should actually be awful to kids, and then give those few handful of weirdos 50% of the airtime. So suddenly people are driving, you know, on their way to work, listening to the car radio, and 50% of the time on the radio, it's someone saying that children are evil and we need to punish them all the time. And then after a few months of that, some people start to think, oh, well, they wouldn't constantly be saying this. They didn't have some point. Maybe children are evil, you know. And so then the referendum on children's rights scrapes by on, you know, like 65%. And you're thinking, who are the 35% of people who think children are evil? And so then if you have it on marriage equality, mm-hmm. where there is more, you know, people who would have a weird, you know, fucked up idea of who gay people are or whatever, and you have to give them, so you have, you know, queer kids going to school passing by posters that saying they're child molesters. So no column, it did get really nasty, even though it was relatively civil in comparison to some of them, because we had this deep conversation 18 months previously, but it wasn't. And the other thing is that we're pushing on an open door. Again, I think that underestimates or it doesn't give enough credit where credit is due. You know, the marriage equality thing was an absolute epitome of a grassroots thing. It started 40 years previously when an absolutely tiny number of really brave men and women decided, you know, in some meeting that they had in the back of a pub somewhere, decided they were going to stand up publicly and say, I'm a queer person, at a time when that was so brave. And it took 40 years then of tiny little marches and protests getting slightly bigger and all. It then took, you know, another 20 years of your brother coming out and your uncle Tom and his good friend David coming out and the woman who teaches your kids and the red-haired girl who sells you the stamps in the post office, of them coming out and saying, I'm also a gay or a lesbian or whatever, and that changing the country. But politicians still didn't believe that we had it in us. Politicians, if we'd be waiting on politicians, we wouldn't have marriage equality and we wouldn't be anywhere near it. They didn't trust the electorate. They're like RTE. They really, you know, they have a very low opinion of their own audience. And but queer people wouldn't shut up about it. And then over time, queer people's mothers and friends and neighbors and colleagues also started to not shut up about it. And so this grassroots organization eventually forced politicians into doing the right thing. Politicians who did not believe it was going to pass, they still didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And then we won it in a landslide, of course. So we weren't pushing on an open door. We were pushing on a door that people were literally blocking access to. So I love Colm. He's a great guy, one of the most fun people to hang out with. If you ever have a chance, you absolutely should. So I'm just very respectfully disagreeing with my fellow queer writer, Colm, saying, no fucking way. Yeah, you know, correct the record. But yes, apart from that, love Colm. Go Colm. So. Buy his book, because, you know, he's not very successful. But there's one called Brooklyn. Yeah.
Well, I thought if anybody has any questions, we could
take 57. A bit. Yes, I look great. I look really good.
Does anyone have a question they'd like to throw out?
Yes. That's Robin from Manhattan. She's come to my show in Manhattan in the Irish Arts Center.
Oh, fantastic. So my question is about the current day use of pronouns. Uh-huh. And it's not about exactly what you've been talking about, but every member of my family is gay. Maybe I'm on the way myself, I don't know. But
it's always time to get things right.
But my question is about the pronouns, the they, the them, the... They become quite confusing because they means more than one person. But then, you know, if you call somebody a he or a she and how to choose what the pronouns are, do you have any perspective on how the pronouns have evolved? And couldn't there be easier words so that...
My perspective is I don't give a shit.
Okay.
Like, it's literally that. I don't give a shit. I don't understand why other people give a shit. Let people call themselves whatever they want. And if it's a little confusing at first, well, who cares? You know, I sometimes meet people who are called Gahalubda, and I have to work that out. It's a slightly confusing at first, and then I stop giving a shit. But I also think that it's generally young people are trying to find out who they are, and they become, you know, very... You know, we all did it. You know, you were a teenager and somebody said something bad about your favorite band. You got very upset. You know, like, young people are trying to find out who they are and figure themselves out in the world. And sometimes they will ask a lot of you and sometimes they will ask a tiny thing of you. And, you know, it's fine. And you know, I think there's also this... People have this weird idea that if you ever get somebody's pronouns wrong, that they're going to get really angry with you. I have often gotten people's pronouns wrong, and nobody's ever gotten really angry. One person got a little snippy once, and that's about it. Like, I think it's we're being told that we have to worry about pronouns, that it's a big issue. And no, how many times has, you know, anyone gotten really upset with you because you got used the wrong pronouns? Like, just live your life and let other people live theirs, and you'll find a way to muddle through together. So, yeah. Yeah. But thank you for your question, Dave.
Hi. You started the conversation by saying that, you know, back in the 80s, you had to check boxes, you know, certain boxes. There was an experience that everyone understood what it meant to be Irish. And I think a lot of immigrants, especially here in America, they still hold on to some of those boxes.
Are you talking about your husband who I met this event? He did the catering for this event. His name is Kian. He's from Leitrim. And he married this wonderful American Greek woman. God, and his sons are studying in UCD.
Look at that.
Yeah, following after Joyce there. So,
not him. Yeah. But so I'm just wondering.
The kids have Irish passports because the Greeks aren't, you know,
the
bureaucracy is too much to get a Greek
as
passport.
The Irish government.
They've got
so,
Irish
yeah.
passports. So the most valuable thing about an Irish person, I mean, you should murder me for steal my passport. Like, an Irish passport is so fucking valuable.
This was a long game, 25 years to get that Irish passport, finally, maybe.
I mean, oh my God, shut up. What is your question?
So do you have a way, how would you describe what it means to be Irish today?
Well, actually, Pádraig over there, the vice consul, we were having a conversation with somebody else outside. And who are we talking to? Oh, my friend Kelly, who has recently discovered through 23andMe that she's 80% Irish, and she had no idea she was adopted. Welcome to the community, Kelly. She's also just recently moved to Chicago. She's only been here 3 months. She doesn't know anybody. Please make friends with my friend Kelly and help her explore her Irishness. Porrick said, I made some joke about anybody can be Irish, and Porrick said, yes, what did you say exactly, Porrick? Anybody can be Irish by birth, descent, or desire. And I have a lot of desire. There's also IB. I thought this was going to be about your bowel movements, and I was thinking, she has an Irish BM. Comes out in a little shamrock. And I agree with that. I think anybody can be Irish. You know, I live in Dublin Central, North Central. We recently had a by-election there, and it is the most, only 34% of people in the last census ticked white Irish, and that feels right to me walking around. It's an incredibly diverse part of the city, and I have never felt any less Irish because of that. I think, when I think back to the grey, miserable Dublin of the 80s that I ran out of, where we thought a tomato was fucking exotic, and now, you know, you can't walk down the street without someone trying to sell you turmeric. So it's a wonderful part of the town to be from. I think the best part of town to be from. It absolutely doesn't affect my Irishness in any way, and I hope that they all feel, Irish in every way too. So, I think Irishness is a state of mind. If you understand how to deal with Irish weather without it depressing you, if you understand that rain is a gift, if you understand, as my mother would always say, there's no such thing as bad weather, there's only bad clothing. if you understand that, then you're Irish as far as I'm concerned. And I can't, and the only, I don't mind getting older, but I do sort of wish I was 19 now. Because the people you could be having sex with as a student in Dublin now are so much hotter. like, we have really embraced the genetic diversity. And your sons are going to have a wonderful time. And I really hope that you are going to embrace having a Brazilian daughter-in-law, because there's a huge Brazilian population in Dublin. Thank God, I'm married to a Brazilian myself. Sorry, Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Hi. Hi. So my name's Macy, and I'm a high school history teacher. And something that I'm curious on what you would recommend. Panty, I'm sorry if I call you Panty by your name.
I don't care. Call me whatever you want, as long as you call me.
Oh, yes. So something that I noticed within my teens is that even though a lot of them could be part of the LGBT community, and I'm pretty much like the only queer trans person on staff, I noticed that they don't feel as embracing, let's say, of that aspect of themselves. And it kind of feels jarring to me because I grew up like in the 2000s where, everything was very much censored here also in the US. And I don't know. But like, it's just kind of disappointing not to see them have that kind of interest. And I feel kind of scared because of what we're seeing here in this country, where there's that pushback against the LGBT community. So what would you kind of recommend for me to do in my school or something to kind of have these kids have a bit of an interest in pride, in a sense, in their identity? Because even though there is a good chunk of LGBT students at our school, I'm like the GSA moderator. And our club has like zero signups and like zero anything. So I'm like, y'all, I know you're gay. Get over here. So what would you recommend, but without it feeling kind of luxury and things like that?
I think it is a tough one because everybody has to do it at their own pace and you really can't, whatever. But I will say that there's also a slight upside to what you've told me. And that is, Sometimes older gays, for example, will sort of complain that younger gays don't appreciate what the older gays did for them.
I'm starting to feel like that, yeah. To be honest.
And I'm always saying, the whole reason that we did the stuff that we did was so that queer kids could grow up and not give a shit about any of it. And now that's actually has happened to some degree, and now you're complaining about it. Like, you don't expect teenage girls to be walking around cheering about the suffragettes every day, because to them it is fully normal that women have the vote. And queer kids, it is perfectly normal for them that some of them might be queer and some of them aren't. That isn't true in everywhere, and depends on where they grow up and and the families they come from, and there can be all sorts of other complications. But in general, teenagers now are much more relaxed about it. So relaxed that they're not necessarily having to really grab onto this queer identity, because it's less of a big deal to them, and that is actually a good thing. It can be a slightly annoying thing. But it is a good thing. And I'm just going to tell you this. So about a year or so after our referendum, and of course, obviously, we're talking Ireland, and it's not the same story, but I just think it's nice. So I grew up in this tiny west of Ireland town. Absolute shithole. Lovely, but nobody knows it's there. And when I was growing up there, I have such strong memories of when YMCA was a huge international giant, number one, and everything. Nobody in Ballinrobe County, Mayo thought they were gay. Nobody. They thought they were just five friends who liked to dress up. We had no frame of reference for a leather queen. You know what I mean? When I remember so clearly seeing Boy George on Top of the Pops, our big thing for the very first time, and the next day in school, it's all anyone was talking about. But nobody was talking about whether he was a gay. It was just, is he a man or is he a woman? The idea that he was a drag queen just never entered anybody's head, because we didn't have any concept of that stuff. It was absolutely a desert for queerness. And queerness didn't even impinge slightly. And then about a year after the referendum result, I was invited back to Ballinrobe County Mayo, the same town. They wanted me to help them launch a booklet that had been written, produced, and designed by the local youth club, and it was a guide to coming out. I was like, what the fuck? And then, so I went down, and I made a little speech, in the middle of the afternoon, with my, parents sitting on plastic chairs in the front row, beside the old woman who used to sell me, comics on my way to primary school, with the police, local police sergeant down the back, and was having a scope, what's going on. And then after I made my little speech, this kid from the youth club also spoke. This tall, confident lad who had a Polish name, a Mayo accent, and gold nail polish. Aww. Like a kid who would never end up writing letters to my mother. And it blew my fucking mind, I just could not believe that this is Ballinrobe County Mayo. It would not compute. And it's incredible. It's amazing. It's really beautiful. Another time I was down there, one of the local pubs, they were raising money for the local football team, and they decided to do a drag beauty competition, and they had me down to be the judge. And all these blokes, who are married to Teresa from who works down the creamery, coming out from the back room of the pub, in a terrible wig and terrible shoes, and they had pretending it was a beauty pageant where they asked them questions. And the whole town was there, whooping it up. And I just thought, I just cannot believe it. So I feel like I've walked into a parallel universe. And there was plenty of teenagers at that, and they just thought it was funny. Well, there's your dad, in 20 deniers, Yeah. So I understand your frustration and all, and I hope that just you, by being vocally supportive of everybody, will do the trick for you. But also, isn't it great that they don't give a shit that much? Yeah.
I think on that note, we should probably wrap, because it's gotten a little late, and I think people might get warm.
But none of you have jobs you're meant to be at. It's a fucking lunchtime.
But I wanted to thank Rory for talking with us and for helping us celebrate Blooms Day in Chicago in 2026.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.